Gothenburg. More information in the meeting section of WBAI.org.
And the previous program was Shortwave Radio Report with Dan Roberts, and that is heard Fridays at 2:30 p.m. here on WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. It is now 3 p.m. Stay tuned for Live on the Fly with Randy Credico coming up.
Okay, that was Anton Karas, the theme from The Third Man, as if you didn't know that. I'm Randy Credico, Randy Credico Live on the Fly here on 99.5 FM Free Speech Radio, WBAI, WBAI.org, here in Brooklyn, and we're live. And, you know, today I'm very excited because, you know, I've been doing radio here for like 7 years, and I've always wanted to have Richard Wolff on this show. And I spoke to him last month. He's a very busy guy. You know, Richard's, you hear him all the time, and he's everywhere, and he's very busy. He's a prolific writer. He's a professor. You know, he does everything that I wish I could do. Very accomplished and very prolific and very serious with a great sense of humor. That's why those reasons are why I like him so much. But so today, I spoke to him yesterday. You know, I was going to talk to him about the stock market, the U-20 number, the rise in inflation, and, all of those questions that he's always being asked. But I said, wait a second. I spoke to him yesterday. I was talking about the Paris Commune because I read his book. It's called Understanding Marxism, and it's brilliant. I read that, and then I started reading Marx again. The first book I read was Marx's speeches in front of the International Working Men's Association during the and after the Franco-Prussian War, going into the end of the Paris Commune. So we had a very nice conversation, you know, a cursory one, and I think we're going to talk about that. In fact, we are. I want to talk about the Paris Commune a little bit with Richard Wolff. So we'll be right back with Dr. Richard Wolff after this music, which was written right after the Paris Commune.
Un insurgé, son vrai nom, c'est l'homme qui n'est plus à la bête de somme, qui n'obéit qu'à à la raison et qui marche avec confiance, car le soleil de la science se lève rouge à l'horizon. On peut le voir aux barricades, descendre avec les camarades, brillant, blagant, disant sa peau.
Okay, I think it's the insurgency, but in French it's spelled differently. We're back. I'm Randy Credico. We are joined by Dr. Richard Wolff. Thank you for joining me today. It's been a long time since I hung out with you when I was running for governor, I think was the last time.
Right.
I ran in third in a three-horse field.
There we go.
There we go. So it's been 152 years. I know you get asked these questions about the economy and Marxism and all that, but is the you know the book I'm talking about, the Civil War
Absolutely.
In France?
Yes. Yeah, you know, the Paris Commune is a very, very, very important historical event. It doesn't get the respect as that it deserves. So I am very, very pleased that you have found your way to making it a topic for today. And it deserves it in part not only because it was a historical moment of enormous importance, but because it is in many ways as relevant right now, right here, as it was, you know, 150 years ago when it happened. And I think I can, in a few words, if you give me the time, I can make that case.
I will. I'm going to give you most of the time. I'm going to ask a few questions. I just want to say that the book we're talking about, there are three speeches that he gave in front of the International Working Men's Association, three speeches just prior to the Franco-Prussian War in the summer of 1870, and then which didn't last long, and then right after the collapse and the abdication and the surrender of the French by Louis Napoleon, and then one at the end, which I got to tell you something. It's a piece of literature. That last speech by Marx really is an incredibly written piece of literature. And one last thing I will say is that the introduction by Engels is enough to fill an hour in this show. So am I right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's a good way to get into it because the Paris Commune exploded in 1871, quite rightly, as you say, in the immediate aftermath of a war, one of several, a war between France and Germany that the French lost and the Germans won. It was part of the unification of many small countries into that country we now know as Germany. That was just coming into existence under their leader at that time, a man named Bismarck. And he defeated the French, who were led at that time by a descendant of the original Napoleon. This one was called Louis Napoleon, a pale copy of his ancestor, and the French army collapsed, and the French lost the war. And in the collapse of the French government, all of the failures that had been covered over by the war, all of the internal conflicts that had been obscured by the usual surge of patriotic propaganda, the evil, awful Germans and the great and noble French, and who were fighting for civilization and progress and everything that's good against the Germans, who were everything bad. And of course, by the way, the Germans had the same game going, only the reverse, who was good and who was bad. Suddenly, all of that patriotism disappeared, and the French people confronted the fact that they were led by people who couldn't make their domestic economy work, they couldn't make their society hold together, they couldn't win a war. They were, in fact, as corrupt and broken down as we now know in historical looking back. We now know that that's what they were. But suddenly, the French people were confronted with how fake their leadership had been. And they were, as a people, as you might imagine, embarrassed, ashamed that they had been hoodwinked by people who were telling them stories to make themselves look good, but hiding the horrible difficulties. And in their anger at having been treated by their own leaders in this way, the French people, particularly in the city of Paris, it's called the Paris Commune for that reason, the people of Paris, and I should explain, Paris is the capital of France. but much more so than in many countries, it's also the center of French politics, French culture, French art, French history, where its kings and queens have resided. It is really very much the center of that country. So the people of Paris rose up, and I mean that literally. They threw out the old governments, all of them. They told Louis Napoleon, you know, get out of here, we don't want to see you. They told the army not to dare to come back in its big defeat to reoccupy Paris. They were starting a new society, and they were going to elect people who were common people. They weren't kings, they weren't queens, they weren't big businessmen or bankers or any of the kinds of people that had been running France up until that time. It was workers and very small individual business people, craftspeople. Those were the ones, artisans, storekeepers, who rose up and set up a brand new government. And in order to signal how different they were, how opposed they were to all of the corrupt, old, rotten system, they called it a commune. The French word, by the way, is very similar to the English word community. They have the same roots in ancient Latin, etc., etc. So it is a famous, famous experiment in genuine working class self-government. The working class took over so that it wasn't just any more workers who went to work and did their jobs. These same workers who went to work and did their jobs, when they came home from the job, were the political leaders of the community as well. And the reason the speeches you've referred to in the book are such wonderful pieces of literature is that Karl Marx, at the time of the Commune, was living and writing in London. London is just a few hours' time from Paris. He wasn't very far across the English Channel in Britain, and he followed the events in Paris literally, day by day, with the newspapers and his own friends and associates who were French, who were in Paris, and who kept him informed from the ground exactly what's happening. And for Marx, it was the most exciting thing he could imagine. He was by now an older man. He had written his work, his critique of capitalism, his argument that the human race can and should do better than capitalism, just as the human race had figured out how to do better than slavery and put that behind it, and just as the human race had learned how to do better than feudalism and get rid of that. Now it was capitalism's turn. And he predicted it, he said it was coming, and then it came. In the months in the summer there of 1871, the people of Paris rose up and did exactly what Marx had said would be the next phase, as the working class would no longer be willing to be told what to do, when to do it, how to do it, where to do it, working their butts off to produce profits taken by a different group of people, the owners, the employers. All of that came to an end, and Paris was the place where it happened, and 1871 was when it happened.
Right.
And
can I just jump in for a minute? I just want to, that's when the February Revolt, and you know, because there was a government set up in September after the collapse of the the Louis Napoleon regime when he left, and there was it was in 1871 when they set up the Paris Commune, and Thiers and his crew all went to Versailles. So that's right. When the real problem. How did it lead up to that? That's what I wanted to ask you. I want to go back to him coming into it, Louis Napoleon, which was after the Continental Revolutions of 1848. And there was a big change in France, but that quickly changed again, and he was able to seize power, Louis Bonaparte, for the next 20 years. And there was a lot of economic success in Paris, in France, during his reign, wasn't there?
Well, you know, it depends on how you set it up. Well, here's what happened. The French Revolution, let's go back, 1789, just a little bit after the American Revolution. The French Revolution in 1789 was the official end of French feudalism. The old feudal lords, the Roman Catholic Church in France, together running that society, owning huge tracts of the land of the country, with a mass of people being serfs. In the French Revolution, a lot of those people had their heads cut off by the guillotine. All of that was brought to an end, and the original Napoleon took over and kind of finished off French feudalism and turned it over to capitalists, businessmen, merchants, bankers, who kind of took over. But the old feudals didn't go quietly. They tried a comeback. They first got rid of Napoleon, if you remember your history a little bit, buried him on the island of Elba in the Mediterranean so he wouldn't come back, so they could kind of rebuild a little bit of a kind of compromise between the defeated feudalism and the emerging banker and big business capitalism. And they ran this kind of compromise, if you like, from around 1815 to 1848. In 1848, France had another revolution. France is a country of many revolutions. This time, however, the revolution was different. The enemy wasn't feudalism. Mostly that had already been defeated. The enemy was this compromise between a shrinking, dying feudalism on the one hand and the emerging big business, big banker, financier capitalism. And the revolution against them was made by the working class. This had never been seen before. Even the great French Revolution of 1879 was largely a revolution of peasants, of farmers. France was still an overwhelmingly agrarian country at that time. What happened in 1848 was that France had developed, in its capitalist phase, a real working class, urban, working in factories, and they weren't happy with capitalism, not at all. And they weren't happy with the deal between capitalism and feudalism. It was making bankers rich, it was making the new class of capitalists rich, and it was keeping the old feudals in a kind of reasonable in-between a position, even though they weren't politically powerful. But the class that really got nothing out of it was this new emerging working class, industrial, urban working class. So they exploded in 1848. By the way, I should make clear, all over Europe, 1848 was a year of incredible revolutions. And this one scared the old feudals, because they weren't going to make a compromise with these workers. They were in no mood to make compromises with a dying feudalism. But even more scary was the fact that these workers were not interested in making a deal with the new financier employer class, because they confronted them as enemies in the workplace every day, nickel and diming them, forcing them to work long hours, cutting their pay, and all of that. So when they exploded in 1848, it was a very violent and a very powerful shaking of France, which still remembered the old French Revolution of 1789, but this one was more serious. And precisely for that reason, in came Louis Napoleon, the descendant of the original Napoleon, promising everybody he would in some magical way fix all of this, that they should reconstitute the French Empire, and that the French would be able in some way, no one quite spelled out, to get them over and beyond this revolution. But basically what he did, two things. Number one, he finished off what remained of the feudal. He just basically got rid of them. He made it a full-fledged capitalist economy. Much of what the feudals had still owned moved into the hands of the capitalists. They therefore had a lot of money. They could develop the economy, as you said, in the 1860s and 1870s. That was also a time when the French were very active in creating an empire, like the British had done earlier in Africa, in Asia, and milking that part of the world for all kinds of wealth that was brought back to feed the French. But by 1870, the corruption again, the capitalists who had to buy the government to get their favors, who had to fund the empire that was being built overseas, you had that very rot from within that happens so often to empires, and by the way, to our own right now as well, and for very similar reasons. And so by the 1870, the jig was up, because he went to war against the Germans, who were likewise building an empire at that time, and the Germans outmaneuvered him at every step. And so in a sense, the curtain was torn aside, and the rot inside the French society was obvious for everybody to see. And they couldn't solve their problems with their empire anymore, and their army was shown to be weak and corrupted by the businesses who had sold them faulty guns and faulty ammunition to make an extra buck, etc., etc. So that's when the French, the Parisians, arose to really try to do something very different.
You know, you go back to 1851 when he got power, and this is something that Ingalls points out, is that the machinery of power that Napoleon set up in 1798, which was the police, the military, the judiciary, that was all used by every government from that point on up until 1870. I mean, the machinery of government, and it didn't matter if it was in the hands of Louis Philippe or Louis Napoleon or anything in between. They had the machinery there to keep, and this which was broken down when the Paris Commune happened. They got rid of all of those. So talk about the machinery of government that keeps capitalism or keeps the ruling class in power.
Okay, good. Perfect question. Very quickly, the feudal leaders before the French Revolution, and then the combination, let's call them the deal makers, who were a declining feudalism and a rising banker and manufacturer and capitalist class, they right away all understood one basic lesson that Americans need to learn again right now. If you put all the feudal landlords together, and you put them together with all the big bankers and all the big manufacturers, and let's just call them, for lack of a better term, the employer class, it is a tiny minority. Just like if you put all the employers in the United States today, and you add them all up, it's less than 1% of the population of the United States. Therefore, if the feudal landlords, one kind of employer, or the capitalist banker businessman, another kind of employer, if they are together a tiny minority, then the only way they can rule a large society in which they are a tiny minority is if they develop a very well-heeled bureaucracy, a highly specialized group of people that they choose, that they pay, that they use their taxes to keep those people in power. They have to have, as you put it, the machinery of government, the elected officials, the parliament, the court system, the jails, the police, all of that has to be set up, because otherwise a tiny minority, feudal lords and capitalists, cannot control a large majority. That's why every capitalist government, including the one we have now, is built in basically the same way. It's a mechanism, a machinery, to enable a minority, the capitalists, the employers, the super rich, on the one hand, to control, direct, dominate a vast majority. And the reason the Paris Commune is so important is that it was a revolt against exactly that. The slogan of the Paris Commune was self-government by working people. In other words, it defined itself as a historic breakthrough in which the people who were always dominated by the machinery of government remove that machinery and finally govern themselves. And that was what the Paris Commune did. It had little committees in every neighborhood. They elected people to be on the next level committee. Everything was done by the working people themselves. No specialized class of bureaucrats, of office holder, none of that old established machinery. Everything was people meeting together where they lived, where they worked, to run these institutions themselves.
You know, this put a lot of fear in the establishment, and they set up the government in Versailles, an illegitimate government. You know, Louis Napoleon, you know, was part of that Versailles. One of the members of the legislature in Versailles was Victor Hugo, who ironically was banned from France. He, along with this great satirist, is my idol, Henri Rocafort, there was a great painting of him escaped from Caledonia by not Monet, but to somebody else. I'll get to that in a minute.
Victor, that's a very important point, because Victor Hugo was the great novelist of this period in French history, and his great novel, Les Misérables, The Miserable People, is about the suppression of the mass of the people by this combination of a feudal, dying feudal old class and a rising new capitalist banker employer class, and the horrible way they treated the average people of France. He was the chronicler, the great writer of that period. To this day, every single French village or town has a, you know, an avenue Victor Hugo because of the honor. There's really nobody quite in that class in French literature, because he was the literary spokesman for what the revolt of 1848 had begun and what the Paris Commune took this enormous step further.
Right. We're talking with Richard Wolff, the great writer, Marxist economist. By the way, some people would consider that an epithet, to be calling someone a Marxist anything. You, I know, wear it on your sleeve with pride, Richard.
Absolutely. And you know, not only do I wear it with pride, but I want to tell you that, you know, anybody around the world, anybody who takes seriously understanding how societies work, knows that there are great writers over the last, let's say, 300 or 400 years, who have been able, in various moments, in various countries, at various periods of time, to be able to understand. So let me give you some names. Adam Smith, there's a famous one. He understood a lot about capitalism. David Ricardo, another British person, like, well, Adam Smith was Scottish. David Ricardo was in London, so we'll call him English. These were great writers. John Stuart Mill is another one. Victor Hugo, we just mentioned. But among them is the German Karl Marx, you know, who lived literally from the beginning of the 19th century to near the end of the 19th century, wrote fantastically, prolifically about capitalism. Unlike Smith and Ricardo, his analysis of capitalism came from the perspective of a critic, whereas Adam Smith and David Ricardo talked about capitalism. And Marx, by the way, was a great student of Smith and Ricardo. He comes a few decades later, so they didn't live at the same time. But Marx learned, he said, everybody should read Adam Smith and Ricardo. They like capitalism, but they are very insightful. And if you were an honest intellectual, and unfortunately they're a bit rare, especially in the United States, you would know that the intelligent person, the thoughtful person, is a person who doesn't just read one point of view on something as controversial as capitalism. Of course you should read the people who like it. Sure, do that. But you also should read the people who are critical and then make up your own mind. But you enforce your own stupidity if you don't read both sides. It would be as if you knew a family up the street that you wanted to understand. And so you went to their house, and you knew only one thing, that they had two children, one of whom thought it was the greatest family in the world, and the other one thought it was a psychological basket case. My question to you would be, do you talk to only one kid, either one? No, because you wouldn't get a reasonable balanced view. You talk to both kids, ask whatever questions you think are appropriate, and then draw your own conclusion. But you don't shut yourself off from the critical perspective. Not only Karl Marx at the time of the Paris Commune, but Marxist economists ever since have developed an enormously rich tradition of criticism of capitalism. A person who lives today in a world that is overwhelmingly capitalist and chooses not to expose himself or herself to the critical literature of Marxism is a person who doesn't understand the first thing about learning and about understanding and about proceeding in a reasonable way to look at the two or three or four sides of a question in order to reach an intelligent conclusion of your own. That is nothing to be proud of. That's something to be ashamed of. And the fact that here in the United States, Marxism is excluded from the curriculum of most economics programs in American universities, and I've taught in a whole bunch of American universities throughout my life, so I know what I'm talking about. The fact that Marxism is virtually rare to find and excluded is a testimony to the one-sided, lopsided, backward nature of American economic education. And it means that we don't have in America the kind of people who would have learned from the critical insights of Marx, even if they ended up disagreeing with Marx, which is fine to do, but they would have learned what a critic has to teach. You know, every newspaper has a movie critic, or a theater critic, or a dance critic, or an opinion critic. And we say we want to hear what the critics have to say. You don't have to agree with it, but you understand the critic is an important function. The greatest body of literature criticizing capitalism is Marxism. To be proud that you don't know anything about it tells us nothing about Marxism, but it tells us a lot about you.
That's really well said. I totally agree. And I like just reading this, you know, and I read the Communist Manifesto and Das Kapital. You know, Marx is a great writer, and everything he said back then has really come into fruition in this country. There's nothing that he talks about in the Communist Manifesto that hasn't come into fruition in this country.
Well, let me give you an example. I'll give you two quick examples. The most famous one, the leader of the Russian Revolution in 1917 that established the USSR, in a way the first successful, long-lasting effort to go beyond capitalism, the Soviet Union, lasted from 1917 to 1989. Remember, the Paris Commune lasted a few weeks.
Few months.
The Soviet experiment lasted 70 years. The Chinese experiment, we're still going and going strong. They came into power in 1949. So as the experiment to go beyond capitalism, as those experiments multiply, the people interested in going beyond capitalism are learning their lessons. What it is you should do that works, and what it is you shouldn't do that doesn't work. Both of those lessons have to be learned, and Marxists have been learning them. But one of the first examples is the leader of the Russian Revolution of 1917, a man named Lenin. One of the most famous pamphlets that he ever wrote, The State and Revolution, is based on, as many of his writings were, his very close study of Marx's essays on the Paris Commune. He wanted to go further. He wanted to have a revolution that put the Russian working class into a dominant position in Russia, the way the Parisian working class had acquired a dominant position in the government of Paris, even though it didn't last very long when the French army came in and put it down. By the way, the Russian army tried to come in and put down Lenin's revolution, and they had a civil war inside Russia in 1918 and 1919. It was called the White Army. That was the one that wanted to get rid of the Marxists, versus the Red Army, which was the army of the revolution. And the Red Army defeated the White Army. And since I'm talking to an American audience, I like to remind you that the United States invaded the Soviet Union, sent 10,000 American troops who landed on Soviet soil and fought with the White Army against the Red Army. They were defeated, but Russian soldiers never landed in the United States, but American soldiers did land as a hostile force in Soviet Russia. And if you didn't know that, it's because the kind of education we get here in the United States leaves out the inconvenient truths. Wow. And now to the final point. The Chinese, Mao Zedong and others, also were students of the Paris Commune. Now, we can debate all day long. Did they get the right lessons from what they studied? Did they draw the right conclusions? I would say they did in some cases. They didn't in others. But no one who wants to understand what revolutions have been in the last 100 years, what kinds of revolutions are being planned and developed now all over the world, they have to understand that the Paris Commune is that important historical first experiment that is informing all of these efforts now, and that just underscores why it's something you should know more about than you probably do.
Right. Well, I'll tell you this. The Paris Commune definitely is an epic that certainly needs to be studied. Would you say, because I saw you speaking at Zuccotti Park in 2011, I think that was you many times.
Yep, it was.
And so the way that was a microcosm, because it was crushed. I was arrested on the night that it was crushed. But that put fear. That little between Broadway and Sixth Avenue or whatever it's called down there, that little piece of territory really did cause fear in the powers that be, not only in this city, but in Washington and around the country.
Absolutely. Let me remind everyone, in those 4 months, August to November in the year 2011, 350 cities in the United States, in every one of the 50 states, at least one city, copied New York, copied Zuccotti Park, got together people in the town green who began to discuss among themselves how they could make American society better, less unequal, less unfair. Look at the spectacle we're observing now. A Congress that can't function, a Republican Party ripping itself apart, a government unable to do its business. We're not out of the woods. We have many of the same problems of a tiny minority using an overblown government machinery, not doing a very good job, and I'm being as polite as I know how. The reasons to get human beings together to do better than we're doing as a system are as strong today as they were in 1871 in France. So the impetus, the support, the urgency, the thought, yeah, it's all there. And the Paris Commune, if you study it, is the valuable study of one of the efforts just like what we saw being made in the autumn of 2011. And I dare say, if the activists who made Occupy Wall Street happen in 2011 had spent some time in their schooling, in their own reading, studying the Paris Commune, they could have and would have done a significantly better job, kept it going for a longer time, been able to understand, because, by the way, Marx was very critical. He celebrated the Paris Commune, but he also said they made major mistakes. And it's very important that people understand that. This was no cheap shot. This was no celebrating, oh, wonderful, wonderful. No. This was a Marx who understood how it was an enormous historical step forward, but he also understood that it made major mistakes, it made major miscalculations, and those had to be understood if the next experiments in going beyond capitalism would work out better. And that's exactly what Lenin did, try to learn from the mistakes of the Paris Commune, and that had more than a little to do with the fact that the Paris Commune lasted a few weeks and the Soviet Union lasted 70 years.
Right.
You know, and the lessons to be learned nowadays are the lessons being learned by anti-capitalists around the world. Here's what Russia did good that you want to copy. Here's what Russia did very bad that you don't want to copy. And ditto for the Chinese or the Vietnamese or the Cubans or anybody else. Capitalism learned from its early experiments what to do and what not to do. That's how it ended up being a global system. And whatever comes after capitalism is going through the same process now.
Well, you know, Occupy Wall Street, I think, lasted from October to December something. And the Paris Commune really got underway in February. And it lasts, I guess, weeks. You could say 8 or 9 weeks. But it certainly they made mistakes. And one of the mistakes that Engels points out in the introduction to this book is that they didn't seize the bank. You know what I mean?
Right.
Now, I don't know what kind of difference that could have made by it's not a functioning bank at that time because you're surrounded by Bismarck's German troops and you're surrounded also by this new confederation of soldiers that that Thiers put together once Bismarck said it's okay now we're a little fearful of there being an example here. So what was first of all the point of his criticism of not seizing the bank?
Very good. Very, very good question. So let me explain. the people at that time believed that what the big banks, the central banks, and what they do is somehow neutral. It is managing the money that we all need. You know, we go to the market and we need to buy food for this evening or clothes to keep us warm. And money for them was just this sort of mechanical, technical thing. And the bank was simply the place that managed it in the way we all need. And Marx said, don't be naive. The bank works in very particular ways. It doesn't do what we all need. First and foremost, it does what the capitalists need. They're the ones who put the bulk of the money in the bank. They're the ones who borrow the most money from the bank. And you can be damn sure that they're going to make sure that that bank works for them. And if it means that the bank does things that hurt average people, the bank's going to do them if there's profit in it for the capitalists and the bankers. Why do I stress that? Because that lesson hasn't been learned right to this minute. I give you the simplest example. We have a big central bank in this country. We don't call it the way the Europeans do, the Bank of Italy or the Bank of France or the Bank of England. We call it the Federal Reserve System. Well, the Federal Reserve System over the last 12 months has raised interest rates by an enormous amount. Why? They explained to us, just like the banks did in the just before the Paris Commune. Oh, we're just managing things, you see. We have an inflation, and in order to stop an inflation, what you have to do is raise the interest rate. It's all this sort of mechanical, technical, economics, nothing for you to be concerned about. Well, that is BS. The Federal Reserve doesn't have to raise interest rates to stop an inflation. The Federal Reserve could do what, ironically, President Richard Nixon did back in 1971. You know what he did? He imposed a wage price freeze. August 15th, 1971, Mr. Nixon goes on radio and television. And here's what he says to the American people. We have a terrible inflation. We have to bring it to an end. And here's what I'm doing. As of tomorrow morning, at 8 o'clock, any businessman or woman who raises the price of anything they make or sell, we will come for you, we will arrest you, and you're going to go to jail. Ditto, any worker, any union who raises the wage they demand from their employer, we will come for you, we will arrest you, and we'll throw you in the clink. The thing was called a wage price freeze. It was originally scheduled to last for 90 days. It was extended. Why? Because it was so successful. It brought the inflation down overnight. That is a policy. The Federal Reserve didn't use that policy. They're so afraid of the people, they don't even discuss that policy, let alone give a reason for why they don't use it. Instead, they raise interest rates. And you know who gets hurt by that? All the little people. Raising an interest rate is the hardest thing to do if you're poor. You can't pay the higher interest rate, or if you're in the middle. Rich people don't give a damn about that. That's what means to be rich. You can pay the higher interest rate. So it discriminates against poor and middle-income people, and it's the best thing for rich people. That's why the Federal Reserve uses it. To think that you don't have to interfere, that you don't have to take over the money system and reorganize it with different people working for different other people under a different system, is to make a terrible mistake. That's what Marx explained to the communards, and here it is. I've got to explain it to my audiences a long time later because it's a lesson still not learned.
Right. We're talking, Rich. Rich, we only have a few minutes left, and we have to do some business here. I mean, there's so much I wanted to talk about. The Paris Commune was totally, savagely shut down. And thousands of people, women and children, were killed. They were gunned down with machine guns or whatever those French, rotary guns. And thousands were just killed. And that was the message that this guy, who had been a hack for under Louis Philippe, I mean, he was able to function under any French government. Thiers was his name, and he made millions of dollars as a functionary during this. He, like, just set the dogs loose, on everybody in that commune, and they wiped it out. What can we say, just in closing? And I did want to talk about Rosa Luxemburg with you. I did want to talk about Gramsci with you, and all of this. And I just don't have enough time. Can I get you back when you have
Absolutely.
Some time to talk about them? Just give us a 1 minute summary about the Paris Commune, and then I gotta go out with some music and do some business for the station.
Sure, the Paris Commune was the signal to the capitalist system, your time on this earth is limited, that you have produced your own gravedigger. You have produced a working class that works for you, that produces the profits for you, that is much, much larger than you, and you're abusing it, and you're ripping it off, and they will take it for a long time. And then one day they won't anymore, and then you're going to see that the system you preside over is due to go away, just like all the earlier systems did, better than its own situation. It always has. We call that progress, and it doesn't stop with capitalism, and you're a fool if you imagine that it does.
Well, thank you. You know what? I learned so much today listening to you, and I didn't ask you once about the Dow Jones. How do you like that?
Okay. All right. We'll hold that for
I want you back soon to talk about the fall of the Socialist Party, not only here, but in Germany and Italy back at the turn of the century, the 1910s. Okay? Can I get you back on that?
Absolutely, Randy. Be glad to do it.
Okay, Richard Wolf. Thank you, Doctor. All right, we'll be right back. Here's some more music from the Paris Commune days, and we'll be right back.
Les révoltés du Moyen Âge l'ont arboré sur main bétoire, emblème éclatant du courage. Toujours il fit pâlir les rois. Le voilà, regardez, il flotte et fièrement il bouge, c'est l'ombris au combat préparé, osez, osez le défier, notre superbe.
I don't know the name of that tune. I just slapped this rundown this morning and was able to find some music that was written right after the Paris Commune, like in the 1880s, 1890s. It's not important, but it's nice music. When we get out of here, we're going to play from Roger Waters, his Saeira. Brilliant opera on the French Revolution. We'll play that at the end. But before we do, Reggie, I learned a lot there. Okay, I thought I knew a lot about the that period of time. But Richard Wolf, like, that 50 minutes went by like that, and
it did
only here.
It did
only here. Where do you get to see Richard Wolf above ground and not on just the internet? You know what I mean? I'm talking
right.
about on terrestrial.
Right. It's few and far, and this is one of the few, and definitely. And I loved how he correlated that with the present time, and how the good question that you asked comparing to Occupy Wall Street, which happened, I can't believe, over 10 years ago at this time, and how those two movements, per se, compared to each other. And I just find it's always good to know what your past is. in order. I think this was just a great example of that.
And there's another reason why you should be supporting the station, Reggie, because, you know what I mean? We've been talking about Julian Assange forever. Last week we had Adam on talking about whatever we were talking about the socialists, Eugene Debs, and material that's kind of abstruse to a lot of individuals. And you're not going to see, as he said, in the standard curriculum in any school in this country. And it's right here at WBAI that you get this kind of programming, folks. And that's why I'm asking you, Reggie, to go to the phones and call that number. Once again, what is it, Reggie?
That number is 212-209-2950. That number again, 212-209-2950 is the number to call to show your support to a radio program like Live on the Fly with Randy Credico, as well as the station that gives it its platform, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.
And Reggie, so they can make a direct pledge. We don't have a premium today. Mm-hmm. I wasn't able to get it together. So, and you know, you're not doing this for the premium, but you are doing it. We'll have a premium of Richard stuff the next time he's on.
Right. But
Reggie, I'm saying just a direct donation to this station. They go to 212-209-2950.
Correct.
And they can either do it just for the station, or you can single out my in the name.
Either way, it's going to the same place.
Right, right. Or you can go to give2wbai.org. Mm-hmm. If you want to continue, I mean, folks, I enjoy doing this. And it's amazing the guests that I've had on, the guests you in the programming on 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, that you only get here. Folks, if you want to preserve it, you can't just sit there and after it's dead say, wow, I missed that. Well, you can prevent that from happening. You can prevent saying, I missed that. Well, I got to listen to Brian Lehrer now. Is that what you really want to do? 212-209-2950.
So you're not going to say anything about the Argyle Sox again?
The Argyle Sox and talk about bay windows in East Brooklyn that should be torn down and for regular windows. What I'm saying is, Reggie, is that there are ways they can contribute. They can do it through the internet to give to WBA.org,
right.
And they could become a buddy quickly. Mm-hmm. The buddy. Give me that in 30 seconds.
All right. Becoming a buddy is all you got to do is call the number, as you said, 212-209-2950, or go to WBAI.org, or go to give2WBAI.org. They're going to ask you, you tell them to become a buddy. They're going to ask you, well, how you want to pay. Through your checking account, through your credit card, debit card, and it's as easy as that. And it's automatically whatever X amount of that you accept, it'll take out of your card or out of your account until you say, "I don't want to do it anymore." And it's tax deductible, and it's
that's right.
And it's an extremely effective way for us to get going and maintain what we have been doing for over 60 years now. Well, actually, next week we will be celebrating 63 years.
Being
part of the Pacifica Radio Network.
Lou Hill got involved. You see, he didn't just sit on his butt.
Oh, he
actually got involved. People are sitting on their butt right now just listening and not getting involved. Listen, we just talked about the Paris Commune. Those mm-hmm. people got involved. They got out there and did things. And then some people who couldn't do anything gave money. They supported them. They gave them Occupy Wall Street. People sent in food that couldn't help out.
They did.
So that's all we're asking is to pitch in. We're all in this together. If you're just listening, you're dead weight. You're dead weight to the future of this station. You can't just do that. And as we go down the toilet, this country, and what are you going to do with the money that you're saving? The millions, the tens of millions, or the 20, whatever you have, you know, do it. This is what you do. You support this station because it's something. This is like the Maltese Falcon. There's only one of them. And once you lose it, Casper Gutman and Humphrey Bogart, Sam Spade, and Mrs. O'Shaughnessy are not going to be able to find that Maltese Falcon. All right?
Right,
it's too valuable. The station is too valuable. Don't let it slip away. Now, I don't want to slip away. Once again, 212-209-2950. Do it. That's your duty.
Don't go
AWOL to this station. You can't go AWOL. We're in a crisis. I don't know how I can imbue in your head the how important it is to keep the station alive. I know I'm going to say, well, when you come to me in a 6 months from now, I'm going to say, don't talk to me. You had a chance to help out, and you walked away. Well, go buy yourself a beautiful dinner at Peter Luger with the money you saved. All right, folks, we're going to go out to Roger Waters right now. I got to get, like, because he sent me this last night. He knew we were talking about the Paris Commune, and this is from this brilliant, it's Saïda. And this is an aria from it, and it talks about the Paris Commune. Thank you, Roger, for sending this to me last night. See you next week, folks. Maybe.